My name's Mark Houston. I'm an alcoholic. Still got this two-fisted drinking problem. I don't know where I developed that, but I'm grateful to be here this morning. I was talking with my new pal JC this morning. We kind of figured we had to be forgiving and compassionate with Cease, because we just kind of figured that all those times when he was taking shots at us, he was drifting into Alzheimer's, and he thought we were someone he resented from the past. And I want to make sure the taper sends this tape to him so he hears that. So JC and I forgive you, Cease. We understand. If you'd finished the rest of those amends, you probably wouldn't be that way. But keep coming back, Cease. It'll work, you know. It's been a lot of fun this weekend. You heard some of the other speakers talk about Tim and thinking he was older, and I didn't think he was older. I just thought he lived up in the hills and didn't get around people very much, you know. See, I was born and raised on a Norwegian farm in Iowa, and we got in town about once a month, and what that does to you is you're pretty much just around animals, so you kind of just talk slow or not at all. And so I just figured he lived up in the hills, and y'all roped him into this committee, but after spending the weekend with him, it's just a front. There's a trapped New York City guy in there, you know. Then he wonders why he's in conflict, you know what I mean? Yeah, trying to talk slow. He reminds me of those ducks, you know, on the surface. They look like they're good, and their feet are just going like a bat out of hell, right? You know, all that stuff going on. And Charlie, he was a hoot. By the way, anytime you see Charlie in meetings, you need to ask him how he's coming on his amends. He owes a lot of them. He's a bad drunk. So you make sure you do that. How's the amends going? Don't even say hi to him. Say, Charlie, how many amends are you making, you know? But it's been wonderful. See, made some new friends and saw some old pals that I've come to know over the years. I wasn't quite sure what Tim was trying to do. He got my butt on a plane about 7 in the morning. I don't leave till 5:30 this afternoon. I thought he's trying to hold me captive or something, you know? But it has been a lot of fun. I thank the committee for bringing me here, and I thank all the people who are involved with committees. I got sober in Denver, and I did that a few times, and I know how much work that is. I also know how gratifying it is, so I want you to know how much I appreciate all that. My sobriety date is October the 19th of 1982, and that happened in Denver, Colorado, and I will be forever grateful for that. The possibilities of a guy like me going almost 18 years and not drinking alcohol just aren't possible. You know, I love the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I love God, and I love spiritual living. And this year has been kind of an interesting year for me. 1994, I started getting asked to speak, and my favorite thing is probably I get a chance to go around the country and do weekend retreats in the 12 steps. And I probably like that as much or more than anything. But after 4 years, I took a year off. Every other position in AA has rotation. And I knew I wasn't going to get rotated out of that, so I rotated myself out. And it was did a lot of work in that time period. Let me ask this question. How many in this room got sobriety, say, from 5 to 15 years? Raise your hands. Oh, good. I got a lot of things to say to you this morning. So that you don't have to have the experience that I had, which is at 10 years I almost committed suicide and got locked up in a nut house. And I'm going to tell you how I kind of got there, and I also want to tell you some things you can do. You don't have to get there, but there was a period of time in Alcoholics Anonymous where I confused activity with action. Big confusion, see? The thing I know today is I must continually, if you're a real alcoholic of the hopeless variety like me, and you do not have a revolutionary spiritual experience, and you do not continue to grow within the framework of that experience, not resting on old laurels or old experiences, you're going to get diseased, and ultimately that could lead to things like depression, suicide, getting drunk again, things like that. And because that was my experience. I'm going to tell you a little bit about what it was like, not much. But back to what I was telling you is, you know, in that time period, that year I took off, I really began to do a tremendous amount of work with the 10th and 11th step. And as I've come to find out as a result of doing that, there's so much more to those steps than I ever imagined before I started doing that process. And I guess after about a year or so went by, just funny how God works, I started getting asked to speak and do things again. And virtually every time, I was the Sunday morning speaker. Now, that's kind of ironic and humorous to me, too. I mean, in a universe, at least in my universe, in which God is in everywhere and in everything, and everything is spiritual and holy and sacred, I mean, I don't. There isn't any difference between a Friday night speaker and a Sunday speaker. My life used to be that way. It'd be like Sunday's the holy day, right? The Sunday speaker is the spiritual speaker. No, what isn't spiritual? You know, one of the assignments I give guys I work with, I tell them to take a month and try and find God in the pots and pans. And they kind of think I'm a little nuts when I do that. But see, spiritual living for me is about what I do from the time I get up till the time I go to bed. That's what it's about, with no big bangs. And spiritual living is not about, well, when I'm in my AA meeting or working with a new man, I'm spiritual, and when I'm at work, I'm not. Where isn't God, and what isn't spiritual, and what isn't holy, and what isn't sacred, and when am I not in church? You know, that comes about through a lot of work with the first 9 steps and living in the spiritual dimension of 10, 11, and 12, which is mostly what I want to talk about. But I do want to tell you a little bit about what it was like to let you know that I didn't come down here for a Kiwanis meeting, stumbled in here by mistake. I was born and raised in Iowa, Norwegian farming community. I'm one of 4 boys and a lot of alcoholism in my family. My dad died of alcoholism in 1986, and got 3 brothers that are having their own amount of fun with all that stuff. And you know, several of the speakers talked about for me my experience and why. See, alcohol has never been my problem. If you're sitting in here and you think your alcohol has been your problem, you've missed something. See, alcohol was my solution to living in this body and interacting with you and trying to get through life. And the reason I know that it was my solution and not my problem is because I kept going back to it years past the point at which I should have been going back to it, but I kept going back to it. And that's because it was the only thing that allowed me to be at peace within myself, in my own skin, interacting with you. And I don't necessarily know what brought that about. I just remember early on, you know, you hear different speakers talk about different things, but I think the thing that I was overwhelmingly aware of was a lot of fear. I told you I was born and raised on a farm, and up till about the 7th grade, pretty well lived in that farm. Then we moved, and this was a town maybe of 300 people. We moved to a town of about 5,000, and I still remember going to school the first day, and I'm wearing bib overalls and work boots, and you know, they were making fun of me until I beat the shit out of a couple of them, because you're a farm kid, you're in pretty good shape, but you know, just almost right from the get-go, I don't know what it was about me, but I was afraid all the time. When I was in high school, I was very little. I graduated from high school 5'6" and 140 pounds, so all of you that height, I've had your experience. And it was a weird deal in high school, because there was a sense of I really didn't fit anywhere, and I would drift in and out of the different little cliques and the stuff they had going on, and I just wasn't ever comfortable in my own skin. And like I said, I wish I had some reason why that is. I don't have one. I just know that that was the truth. A lot of fears and a lot of insecurities and a lot of anxieties and a lot of other stuff. And my dad was a bad drunk, my brother had some problems with alcohol, and I'd kind of made a decision I wasn't going to do that. But I picked up a drink this summer when I was 16 years old, and alcohol almost from the very, very beginning began to have an impact on my life. I didn't realize it till I'd been sober quite a time and began to really take a hard look at my life, but almost from the beginning, alcohol had become a solution to me. Got out of high school in 64, and I went to junior college for a while, and then I went to the University of Iowa and almost drank myself out of that place. And then I went to the University of South Dakota and drinking more and more, and then the Vietnam War came along and I got drafted. And I spent about 13 and a half months in Vietnam, and I came back from there and I finished up college and met a gal, and that was another major turning point when I think of when I think of my alcoholism. And what the turning point was I was born and raised on this farm in Iowa, and I'd been taught to believe all these things. And then I get sent over there, and I realized I'd been lied to. And then I came back, and not only had I been lied to, but when I came back, I couldn't even tell you where I'd been sent to, that I didn't want to go in the first place, that I had to go. But I couldn't talk about that because there was shame about where I'd been. And that began to have an impact on me and how I viewed things. And it caused some a shift in me, a shift in my perception. Because I was born and raised in the town, you know, you didn't lock cars, you didn't lock doors, you knew everyone in the town. And there was a lot of trust in my life, if you will, prior to that experience. And after that experience, a lot of that got diminished. And I married a gal out of college and went to California, lived in California about a year in San Francisco. And I was a daily drinker, and I was an athlete, and I was in good shape. I matured late in life. I started working out and lifting and running and doing all that stuff. And all that did was allow me to probably drink alcohol a few more years before I got into Alcoholics Anonymous. But from there, I took a job change, and I moved up to Eugene, Oregon. And this was about in 1972. And in hindsight, I don't know. I hear this thing about crossing a line. I guess when I look at my experience, does that mean that I lost control? I suspect if that's what people mean by that, then that really began to happen in 1972 and 3. And I was married to this gal. And one of the things that alcohol and my alcoholism did for me is it turned me into someone that I was not. You see, I was raised with good value systems. I was raised to know the difference between right and wrong. I was raised that my word was my bond. I was raised with all those kinds of value systems. And as I continued to drink and progress into my alcoholism, I began to compromise all of it. I began to commit adultery on my wife. I love alcoholics. You know, we hate that word adultery. We prefer to use affairs, you know. I like to call things what they were. But I began to do that, and I wasn't giving my employer a fair day's work. And I began to drift into that thing I call pitiful, incomprehensible moral idealization. You see, I began to compromise all of my morals, and I've turned into something that I absolutely despised. And when you get taken to that kind of a place, you see, and you violate your conscience day in and day out, a minute by minute, an hour by hour, how do you live with that except to drink? Because alcohol had been a solution. And I left that woman in 75, and I moved up to the state of Washington. We'd lived in Oregon for about two and a half years, and in hindsight, what that was about is the guilt, because she was a fine woman, and the guilt of my actions and behaviors, I just couldn't live with it anymore. And so I'd left her, and I'd moved up to Seattle, Washington. I lived there for 2 years. Then I went up to Anchorage, Alaska. If you're an alcoholic, Anchorage, Alaska is a great place to drink. It gets a little weird, though. In the summertime, you have daylight for 22 to 24 hours, so you walk out of a bar at 2, 3 o'clock in the morning. It's like, is it afternoon or is it morning? You know, it gets confusing. You lose days and stuff, you know. When I went up to Alaska to make amends, I was off a year as to when I thought I lived there. And I was up there about a year, and then finally the man I'd worked for several years, he had about all the fun he could stand, and he let me go. And that was in 1978, so from 1978 to 1982, I just began that downward spiral that Bill Wilson's story talks about and a lot of other stories talk about. And it wasn't a fun picture, and it wasn't a pretty picture. When I got sober that morning of October the 19th, 1982, my last drink lasted a year and a half. In all my years of drinking, there was very little times when I wasn't doing daily drinking. I had about 2 weeks, I think, without a drink. Picked up a drink a year and a half later is when I got struck sober. And that's, I don't know any other way to say it. When I got sober, I weighed about 250, 260 pounds. I had brain damage, kidney damage, liver damage, everything I owned you could stick in a duffel bag. And but that morning, in terms of what happened to me, I'd gone to see a counselor. I was married at that time. If you want to call it that, it's more like a war zone, as most of you know if you're drinking and you're pretending that you have a marriage. But And this counselor was pretty intuitive and said to me that I think you're an alcoholic and that I think you're too sick for Alcoholics Anonymous right now, and I think you need to get somewhere and get detoxed. And she hurt my feelings, and so I went and continued to drink. And But my belly button birthday is October the 14th, and some pals of mine come into town, what few pals I had left. And there were a few other mind-altering chemicals that I loved to ingest in, all so that I could drink more, and we had done a bunch of that. And I came home that morning, October the 19th, 1982, and I don't know if it was a moment of clarity. I do know this. My life and my behavior, my actions, and where I was that morning sickened me beyond anything that I could imagine. I could not escape the truth of that. I turned into everything that I despised in a human being. And I don't even know as if I asked God specifically. It may sound bizarre, and some of you might relate to this, but I still don't know at that point in time if I realized alcohol was a problem in my life, because it had been a solution in my life. See, I'm not the kind of guy that if an employer said, "Mark, you need to quit drinking or we're going to let you go," you even hinted to me about not drinking and I'm gone. Whether you're a woman or whether it's a boss or whatever. But I can tell you, I had an experience that morning, not quite like Bill describes, but kind of like Bill described. I do remember in my own way saying something to this power, to God. And I remember that it felt like something was starting to take place inside my body. And then the next thing I remembered, it felt like something that weighed 1,000 pounds was literally jerked out of my body. And here I was, almost dead from alcohol poisoning, but my mind was as crystal clear as it is this morning. And I've never been able to take a drink since then. I tell people this, I got separated from alcohol that morning. And this power has kept me separated since. And I went into a treatment center, and I can tell you my first 2-3 years in sobriety were rough. I had damaged myself in every sense of the word, mentally and physically. And my first 2-3 years in AA, in many respects, were a blackout. And some of you might relate. Now, if you'd asked me at, say, 2 years sober, how you doing, I would have told you I was doing just great. But I can tell you in hindsight, hell, I can't even remember them. And then around three and a half years of sobriety, somewhere in there, I met a man, some of you know, Don P. And Don took me through the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I hadn't done anything really with the book up to that point in time. And I had a revolutionary spiritual experience. And from about 3 years, probably to about seven and a half, 8 years, my life was wonderful in every sense of the word. But I told you I wanted to kind of talk to some of you in that 5 to 15 years. Because some things happened to me, and I didn't set out for these things to happen to me. Is first of all, if you look at what our big book tells us about in the 10th, 11th step, and about a way of living, it gives us some very, very specific disciplines to follow on a daily basis, which I wasn't doing. I was doing half measures. I was doing nothing with meditation. I hadn't done any work with inventory in probably 3, 4, 5 years. And to make a long story short, probably from about 8 years to around 9.5, 10 years sobriety, I got moved into, I call it untreated alcoholism. It was combinations of many things, but about 10 years sobriety, I was within 24 hours of committing suicide. And that's after having had a revolutionary spiritual experience, after having known God. Having that romance with God. And I was within one day of committing suicide. I was reduced to sitting in an apartment crying. And I couldn't even go to the grocery store. And I had people say, "Why don't you drink?" And I said, "Because I can't." They said, "God don't want you drinking. You're not drinking." I don't know if some of you got that or not yet. But God, I was in horrible shape in hindsight. And through a series of events, I wound up in a nut house down in Houston, Texas, and in that nut house, that's kind of a scary deal when you got 10 years sober. You know, first of all, when they put you in those places, you know, you ain't leaving until they deem you're fit to join society, and so, you know, you kind of get like one flew over the cuckoo nest. You get real compliant real quick once you snap to that, you know. But I got in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous then, and you know, I saw that I hadn't made this a way of living, day in and day out. And when I got released from that place, I moved down to Houston, Texas. And this was a whole nother thing for me. I didn't realize at that time, but my attachments to things other than God were also leading to a lot of the problems that I experienced. You and I live in a world of spiritual impermanence, and there's many, many books which talk about attached to God and God alone, for everything you dearly love could be taken from you today. And all these attachments that I had, I moved down to Houston, Texas, and I had a 78 Saab and my big book and about $100 in my pocket. And in hindsight, is one of the best things that ever happened to me, because I got stripped completely free of any support system that I ever had. And there's me, God, and this big book in Houston, Texas. And in the first 2 years after that, I worked and reworked the first 9 steps with a diligence that I'd never brought to the table before. And I began to work with the very strict spiritual disciplines of 10, 11, and 12. And my life has never been the same. In hindsight, when I look at what happened to me in around 10 years, there were a lot of contributing factors to that. I had a lot of unwritten inventory in me. Now, what happens when you get a little time in AA, that's why I said if you got 5 to 10 to 15, if you have the experience I have, here's what happens. You begin to know about this presence, and your life begins to get better. You begin to read spiritual books, and in hindsight, what begins to happen, my ego did another just crafty thing, and that is that, well, I'm just real spiritual now, and I don't really resent anyone, and not really angry, and just a little sunbeam, you know, and what that brings about is complete denial of being a human being. And I tell people later, I must have thought I was chosen to be a spiritual mystic. I wound up a spiritual hemorrhoid. And so I wasn't doing any work with the first 9 steps. You see, I wrote an inventory one time, and I'm going to live in 10, 11, and 12, and I like the easier, softer way. I'll buy that. And the problem was that it didn't work, and I damn near died. And so in those first 2 years, I wrote inventory a minimum 4 times, having reviewed the first 3 steps, so that I had my connection to my first step. What's wrong with me? Am I a real alcoholic? The allergy of the body, the obsession of the mind. Do I have an alcoholic mind? Do I believe the main problem centers in my mind rather than in my body? See, I'll tell you, there's a little story it tells about the kind of mind I got. It's, I'm standing outside the San Diego Zoo drunk, and I'm hollering, "Let me out." See? See, and that's the kind of mind I'm taking into life and relationships and career and money and AA and, you know. And so I sit and I look at that, and you know, I love to talk about page 52, the bedevilments. Because if you want to know if you got some self-will going on in your life, use page 52 as a gauge. And if you don't like what you see, I promise you, you got some self-will going on. And because it says some things in there. It says I'm having trouble in personal relationships. So you might want to take a minute today and look around your life. How are your personal relationships? How's the one with yourself? Heard a speaker say one time, and I can relate to this, if you said to me what I said to me, I'd have to kill you. Well, if you got that going on, you're not having a very good relationship with yourself, you see. If you're sitting in judgment of yourself all the time. But how is it with other people? How is it with your husband, your wife, your boyfriend, girlfriend, your children, your mother, your father, your brothers, your sisters? How is it in AA? How is it with your employer? Are you having trouble in personal relationships? And talks about, I cannot control my emotional nature. Well, how are your emotions in the course of a day? How do you do? And it says, I'm a prey to misery and depression. I can't make a living, and I'm full of fear, and I feel useless, and I'm unhappy. And they call them the bedevilments. And the book goes on to say that my reliance on myself can't solve any of those bedevilments. See, that to me is a description of what the book calls a spiritual malady. The book says I have a threefold illness. I have an illness of the body, an illness of the mind, and I have what the book calls a spiritual malady. Now, the crazy thing is, over the years I've come to understand my main problem does center in my mind. And what happens is, in order to treat my mind, I have to embrace spiritual living. I take a course of action, the rest of the steps, to have a spiritual experience to treat my mind. And so I have to look at that again in my first step and in my second step. You know, is there more past here? See, I don't know about you, but when I had a first step experience, I became a seeker of God. I'm Norwegian and alcoholic, but I'm not an idiot. When I saw that I was going to drink alcohol and I had an unmanageable life, drunk or sober, there was nothing left for me but to seek power. And I didn't care what you all called the power. See, I think people that struggle with the God step need to find someone to take them back and let them have a first step experience. You know? Faced with alcoholic destruction, I soon became as open-minded on spiritual matters. I mean, at that point in time, I was willing to be dipped, dunked, sprayed, and neutered to know God. See, and if you're in that 5 to 15 year window, you probably experienced something else. At some point in time, when you begin a revolutionary spiritual experience, and you tell the creator of the universe that your life ain't your business no more, my experience is that power believes that shit. So what happens at some point in time, in that time window, everything the Creator has made will no longer satisfy you. Nothing but knowing the Creator. And that was another piece that was going on with me. So in that second step, is there more past here? See, is there more past here? We're all here with our knowledge of past experiences and what we think God is and AA and the steps. And is there more past here? Are there dimensions of consciousness with God I know nothing about? Are there dimensions of love and joy and wonder and peace and power that I know nothing about? Yeah, absolutely. See, if there's not, then God is finite and I'm an atheist. See? So my second step, am I willing to be taken past here? Because there's more. See, you go to the ocean with a thimble, you get a thimble full of water. How much of God you want? See, you get to have as much of God as you want. How badly do you want to know God? Bill Wilson, he says, there was a time I needed and wanted God, but soon the sense of His presence was blotted out by worldly clamor, mostly within myself. And I got taken to a place in Alcoholics Anonymous where there was nothing left but God. I had to know God more. See? In the second step, I also get clear on something, that to experience God, I must be out of my mind, because you don't experience God with your mind. You experience God with your spirit, which already knows God. And I begin to open up to that idea that there's so much more that I do not know. I mean, there's some spiritual practices that embrace the idea that God is the great unknowable, and that's my experience. I was sitting in meditation about 3 years ago, and, you know, there's that phrase, God as I understood or understand, right? So meditation, that still small voice, here's what I hear. What makes you think you understand me? Now, that's something to be posed with in meditation, right? That didn't come from my mind, right? So I sat with that a few days. I do not tell people anymore God as I understand God, because I do not understand God. My mind is incapable of understanding God. The best I get to do is experience this power, which I can't even put a name to anymore. But that becomes my second step. If in the book, the promise of the big book in the second step is, if I'm willing to seek God through a course of action, God will disclose Himself to me. You can take it to the bank. You can take it to the bank. One of the men whose books have had some influences in my life, Thomas Merton, he has a great quote I love. He says, those who think they know from the beginning will in fact never come to know anything. Every day I wake up, God, lay aside everything I think I know for an open mind about everything. See? About everything. That's another trap. As you get time, you think you know. See? The longer I'm around, the less I know. Yeah, I heard a pal of mine said one time, the three hardest words for an alcoholic say are, I love you. And I said, well, you didn't drink like I did. Those came easy. Three hardest words for me say are, I don't know. You know, and then I come up to my third step decision. This is another powerful decision to make when you got some time. Am I convinced that my life run of my will cannot and will not work? Almost 18 years sober. And the book describes what that looks like. And there's some great things to look in there in terms of seeing whether or not you got some self-will going on. Like it talks about that It talks about that even when I have kind motives, I'm still wanting to direct the show. See, all that my ego did when I came into AA, it shifted motives. Now today, the way it'll work when it's having its field day is it's kind, considerate, unselfish, self-sacrificing. Okay? But it's still trying to arrange the show. And I sit with that, and I look at that, and I ask myself, is that relevant in my life today? Am I trying to direct the show, you know? And then it once again hits me with the root of my problem is that I'm selfish and self-centered, and it says that I get driven through life. Look up the word driven. It means you have no choice. There was another delusion I suffered in, sober. I would sit and review the decisions I made over the past year, and I actually thought I had a choice in some of them. But I looked at them and realized an idiot could have made a better choice. So what was I missing? And I looked up the word driven, and I saw what the big book meant. When I'm driven by fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, self-pity, I don't have a choice. My ego just convinces me I have a choice. There's nothing I can do. My ego is as mysterious and powerful as God Himself as far as I'm concerned. And the big book's very clear with me about something. Mark, you better be convinced that only God can remove whatever self-will got you blocked off from Him. Wow. Because all your troubles, Mark, are your own making. You know, I hated that for years. See, if you embrace that truth of that statement, you'll stop using words like this. You make me feel. It's your fault. See, that statement, if you embrace it, means you're going to take responsibility for your life from that moment on. Every area of your life, from your finances to your physical health to you name it. See, I'm grateful today that all my troubles are my own making. Back to that main problem centers in the mind because it's a perception. And then a line that's in the big book, and I don't know why we don't talk about this more in meetings, but it says above everything, Mark, you've got to get rid of this selfishness, or your selfishness is going to kill your ass. I think that we should talk about that more in our meetings. See? It doesn't say at that point in time, alcohol is going to kill me. It says my selfishness is going to kill me. Now here's why. If my selfishness, which comes from my self-will, is not eradicated, then I will become diseased. And there will come a time when my mind will go to a strange mental blank spot and remember what will treat that disease, which is a drink of alcohol, and I'll take a drink and activate a phenomenon called craving. So that becomes the heart and soul of what I'm up against at almost 18 years, is what kind of selfishness do I have going on in my life today? In every area of my life, work, AA, spiritual living. Then I make that third step decision. It's not the same decision I made in 1982. It's a whole other thing to make that third step decision where I am today. That once again, you see, I had to have God's help because I got moral philosophic convictions galore and I can't live up to them. And now I stand on that third step decision, right? I'm going to let this power direct my life and I'm the actor and that power is the principle and I'm the agent. Look up the word agent sometime. You know what it says? It says empowered. One who is empowered by another. See, we get to be agents and servants of God. Powerful thing. There is responsibility in that. See? There's responsibility. And we agnostics, there's another line. It says, Mark, why don't you start regarding yourself as an intelligent agent, spearhead of God's ever-advancing creation. There's a responsibility. Every one of your speakers has talked about that responsibility. JC at work, Cease, every speaker's talked about that. Are you willing to stand in the light of that responsibility? Well, I don't know. I just want to get sober, Mark. That's a bit much, don't you think? Talks about the father and the child. See, I don't know where you're at with the God you come to know and love and that loves you. But nothing will ever touch me except what the power wants to touch me, so bring it on. I don't care what it looks like, bring it on. Bring it on. Men and women of faith have courage, they trust their God. Bring it on, I don't care. I'm very clear who my employer is and who I serve today. And it's not in human form, so bring it on. God wants me sick, I'll be sick. If He wants me well, I'll be well. If he wants me poor, I'll be poor. If he wants me rich, I'll be rich. Bring it on. Boy, that's a place to stand, you see. To stand on that kind of a relationship. With nothing between you and that power. Pal, a sponsor about a year ago calls me. He'd been married about 18 years. His wife comes home one day and says, I want a divorce. He calls me. What do I do? I said, you tell her, God bless you, go in peace. He said, are you blankety-blank nuts? I said, no. He said, God giveth and God taketh away. Blessed be the name of God. He was able to practice that and work that. Now, he had to write a lot of inventory to get to that place. You see, attached to God and God only. Why? I'm going to say this again. You and I live in a world of spiritual impermanence. I haven't been sober that long. Seen a lot of men and women die. I live here for a while and I get moved over here and so I attach to God and God only. See, and when you begin to do that, I tell you what starts to happen is you don't take anything for granted anymore. A couple of people have said, this is a gorgeous day. Let me tell you, it is. It might be my last. I ain't going to miss a second of it. And I'm not going to take friends for granted. And I'm not going to take a drink of water for granted. Damn sure not going to take my sobriety for granted. I'm going to attach to God and God alone. Everything gets holy and sacred, you see. Allow people the dignity to be who and what they are. Quit trying to play God in their lives for your own damn selfish, self-seeking reasons, see? That's what I said to that man. I said to him, look, Floyd, you don't know what her path is. See, I tricked him about a month ago. He made a mistake of talking to me about unconditional love, right? I said, oh, so that's just bullshit. You know how we get. I do a lot of work with steps 4 through 9. And I'll tell you why I do that. Face and be rid of the things that have me blocked from knowing God. That's why I write inventory. There is no other reason. Period. When you understand that reason, there's a shift in how you approach inventory. I love writing inventory. I'm writing inventory right now. And I love to write inventory. And all it is, it's going to show me how my selfishness, my self-will, operates on a daily basis with you. That's all inventory is showing me. And it uses 3 different vehicles to do that. Resentment. Every resentment I've ever had comes from attachments I have. If I had no attachments, I wouldn't have any resentments. I write a 4-column resentment inventory, and then I write a fear inventory, and all my fears also come from my attachments. I cannot love anything to which I have an attachment to. Because the attachment normally comes from some sense of pleasure, and then what I do is now I'm trapped in fear and anxiety about it's going to leave whatever it is. And I can't love it. I can't love that way. It's a conditional love. So now you got to fit into my 3rd column. You know, I've done a lot of work. And I've been married and divorced 4 times. Engaged 6 times, right? Had a few attachments. To tell you this program works, I haven't found necessary to get married since 1995. But you see, you can't love from that place. You just can't love people. 5th steps, 6 and 7. I had some experience about 4 or 5 years ago that changed me dramatically when it came to the 6th step and the 7th step and how I interrelate with people. And that is that I begin to see that I was a spiritual being having a human experience. And as much as I love God, and I do, to the point of tears. And I wish everyone in this room could have that experience. Weeping. Where the love of God just runs through every cell of my body. Make you weep like a baby. And I wouldn't want anyone in this room to not know that. To not know that power that's there. And I don't, again, it doesn't make a difference to me what you call it, but. And with everything in my being, I never would want to hurt another human being. Because I know that there's nothing but oneness. There's only a delusion of a separate self. But you see, every day I fall short in thought, word, and deed. And if I do, so do you. So you and I are on equal grounds. See, and the impact of that is when I get to the 8th and the 9th step, is that there isn't any human being who's ever harmed me that ever did that from a awakened state. Nor did I ever harm anyone from an awakened state. The word sin means miss the mark. any time I sin, I do it in ignorance. I'm not awake, aware, mindful, and conscious. And that's the truth of anyone else who's ever, quote, harmed me. And I'm going to sit there and I'm going to get upset with someone who did something in a state of being asleep, in a state of ignorance. See, I've never sinned in a state of awareness that there's only God and there's only love. I never make mistakes from that place. See, that had a profound impact on me. Recently, I had a guy come to me, and he's in the fellowship, and he was going to make amends. And, well, you need to tell me how I harmed you. And I said, look, I have long since got free of the illusion that you have the power to harm me. You didn't wake up one morning and say, I got nothing else to do. I think what I'll do is go slander Mark Houston today. That isn't what happened. You're just like me. I said, I appreciate you coming over, but I love you. You didn't harm me. You can't harm me. Powerful stuff. If you have unfinished amends, please go make them. Make them while people are alive. And if you have family members, get them out of the way. Make those amends while these people are still alive. My mother passed away in January, and my past with her had been all clean. And last year, I was fortunate enough to have 4 or 5 months off, and I wasn't working, and I... in meditation, I've had a daily meditation life since 92. The guidance I had was go up to Colorado and spend time with your mother. She's going to be dead in 6 months. So I did. I went up and sat with my mother for 2 weeks. And she's like C. She was getting Alzheimer's. Do you hear that, C? And, but I sat with her for 2 weeks. And sometimes she recognized me and sometimes she didn't. But see, there was just this peace between us. As far as I know, I don't have any unfinished business behind me. There's another correlation here. I don't know about you, but my inventories always showed a fear of death and a fear of living. And when I finally cleared up all my amends, I no longer had a fear of death, which means I no longer have a fear of life. I didn't know that. The strict spiritual disciplines of the 10th and 11th step allow me to be present to this moment. I understand today when the big book says the fourth dimension, here's what it is for me. The fourth dimension is that I'm present to this moment, and the wonder of just being present to this moment is beyond my comprehension, and it matters not where I'm at, who I'm with, and what I'm doing. I'm present to life, this gift of this thing called life. And when you get taken to that dimension, there will be a whole shift in how you come at everything. Nothing is more special than anything else, you see. No one person is more special than anything else. No one event is more special than anything else. Make you weep like a baby when you have that experience. Disciplines of 10 and 11, they're very strict. You've got some time in the program, done a little work with the steps, you don't have a daily meditation life, please get one. If you ask me as I stand here today, of all the spiritual practices you've ever done, what do you think has had the greatest impact in your life? And I would tell you meditation. Be still and know that I am God. Be still and know that I am God. It was in meditation I began to experience the love of God at a level, a deep level. Tenth step says I've entered the world of the spirit. You see, what that means is I'm a spiritual being having a human experience. And most of the time, if I'm hooked up, I get to watch Mark have his human experience, but I'm not attached to it. And from that position, I can love. You see, I can love. God, what gifts were given in here, see? What gifts were given in Alcoholics Anonymous? And there was so much more available to me in our beautiful big book, and I just didn't know it. But now here's the piece, and then I'm going to close with this. You know, there's a line in the big book that I stay sober based on my fifth spiritual condition, right? Well, guess who's responsible for that? It's not God. I am. You see, I am. My alarm clock goes off 5 days a week, 4:45, and I spend an hour in the morning in prayer and meditation with my Father, with that which created me and sustains me, because of myself I'm nothing. That's holy and sacred time, and I work with the 10-step practices all during the day. The practices of watch and turn and ask and cease. He's fighting anything or anyone, even alcohol. You know that phrase, teenagers, I realized about a year ago, it's the most spiritual phrase I know. It means I've ceased fighting anything or anyone. See? You know, you're going to meet someone for dinner and they call and can't make it. Whatever. She comes up after 18 years of marriage. I want a divorce. Whatever. See? God, it's an incredible way to go through life. See? Position neutrality that the big book talks about in the 10 step. My experience is it's not just about alcohol. It can be every area of your life. You're in a position of neutrality. 10-step talks about the vision of God's will into all your activities, the line of the will. The 10-step for me is about the line of the will all day long. From the time I leave my house till I get back, the line of the will. Can I align with the line of the will, God's will? 10-step talks about I have a new sixth sense, conscious contact. See? God's closer than breathing. I'm no closer to God than when I was on my last drunk. All that's happened is a result of a lot of work with the first 9 steps and the disciplines of 10 and 11. I'm awake, aware, mindful, and conscious of that which is always present to me. That's all that's happened to me, folks. And I don't have to go anywhere to have that experience. 11-step tells me what to do upon awakening. Talks 11 steps about your thought life. You remember we were told earlier on that the main problem center is in the mind rather than in your body. Carpenter said that you will be known by the renewing of your mind. And if we work and rework these steps, we have a renewed mind. We have a renewed mind. And all those incredible prayers that you get to do in the 11th step, pause, agitated or doubtful. Thy will, thy will, thy will. And don't judge what that looks like. See, God giveth, God taketh away. Blessed be the name of God. To live in that. To stand in that, see? 9th step told me what I'm here for. My purpose in life is to serve you and to serve God. And that's it. And the strange paradox is when I surrendered to that, and I did not surrender easily, is when I surrendered to that, I begin to experience some other phrases I've heard about. Wear the world like a loose garment. Seek ye first the kingdom, the rest is get added. Now, I'll tell you what this kind of living did for me. Because we seem to have, we have some attachment to our external world, but at 10 years when I became willing to die the death of self, which is what 4 through 9 will do, my life has been blessed beyond belief. I get to travel all over this country and spend time with people like you who I love and who love me, talking about God, talking about you can know God more. And I get to do it for fun and for free all over the country. I just came back from California. I got to go to a monastery. I get to go to these incredible places. I'm CEO of a company today. When I got sober in 1982, I was working as an orderly in a nursing home cleaning up human feces. Soon to be a published author. I've written 2 books. I'm working on a 3rd book. None of this is of me. There's a story. This little boy, he was sneezing one time. His mother said, Johnny, quit sneezing. He said, Mom, I can't. It's sneezing me. Okay. Well, since the day I came in AA, it's been sneezing me. Okay. The things that I'm talking about and the things that have happened happen through me, and they are not of me. And but I love the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I love the big book, and I love the fellowship. And I want to thank you all for having me down here and spending time with you. God bless you. I love you.